So for the next 3 weeks, I wanted to explore some of the teachings in the Buddha's own words. So I've picked three areas, not exactly three suttas, but I've picked three areas to explore. And tonight I'm going to look at the Kalama Sutta. And I guess I would title tonight's talk, to give it a title, Come and See. Early in my practice, I attended some retreats, some monastic retreats, where there was a lot of chanting that happened. And I was chanting these words in Pali and didn't really know what they meant, but I kind of liked the sound of a couple of these words, and they kind of just resonated with me. And the two words were ehipasiko opanaiko. And I liked the way they rolled off the tongue. I liked the tone that they were chanted in. They just felt good. And as I learned a little bit about these words, I discovered that they represented qualities of the Dharma. They describe qualities of the Dharma. And then as I actually learned what the words meant, they resonated even more deeply for me and have become two of the kind of favorite reflections I have about the spiritual path. So the first word, ehipasiko, basically means come and see. Look for yourselves. Explore the teachings for yourselves in your own experience. Don't accept them just on face value. Don't accept them just because somebody said that they are worthwhile. Come and see for yourself. So that is one of the qualities of the practice. Come and see. In fact, there's one teaching that the Buddha said is the one who knows, the Tathagata, the one who sees, simply points the way. The practice has to be done by yourself. And that's the essence of the come and see. And the second word, opanaiko, means leading onwards. And this also I really like. It provides a description for me of what happens to us as we practice. The mindfulness practice itself, the practice of the Dharma, the practice of observing our experience, of looking at our experience in a non-reactive, mindful way, leads us onwards. It pulls us towards freedom. Simply as a matter, almost just as a cause and effect kind of consequence. As we bring our attention to our experience, we see things, we see new things, and we bring our attention to those things. There's one description of the path of practice, or there's a kind of a map of practice. It's called the progress of insight. And it basically takes us through the stages, or it essentially describes the stages that we go through as we progress in our spiritual life. And it's not a map of things to do. It's a map of what we see. It's a map, basically, of different levels of insights that we come to. But what's so amazing to me about this practice is that every step of the map, the instructions are the same. Pay attention to what is happening right now in the present moment. The instructions don't change. So it really does, these teachings just lead us onward. If we pay attention, it's like they pull us to the next step, to the next step, to the next step. As we pay attention with mindfulness, we see how we suffer. We see how we contribute to that suffering. We see how we can act to not suffer. It's really a very beautiful experience to start to see how mindfulness essentially shows us the way through our life. So the sutta, the Kalama Sutta, explores these two topics a little bit. And I'd like to talk about what was said in the sutta. So the setting for this sutta is in the town of Kesaputta, which is essentially on the edge of a forest, and it's where the people named the Kalamas lived, hence the name, the Kalama Sutta. And this town, being on the edge of a forest, served as a kind of a way station for all kinds of people coming through. And there were a lot of different ascetics and monastics and wanderers that came through this town of Kesaputta. And they all came and they taught their teachings. The people of the town heard the teachings, and they heard a lot of contradictions. They heard people saying, it's like this. And other people saying, it's not like that, it's like this. And only this is true. Nothing else is so. So they were confused. And they heard that the Buddha was coming to town. And they said, well, he's got a good reputation. You know, he's reputedly fully enlightened and knows how to become enlightened. So, you know, it's good to go listen to people like that. So maybe we should go see the Buddha. But instead of just listening to what he had to teach, they decided to ask him a question instead. And so this is what they asked him. First, they described what had been happening for them. There are, Lord, some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta. They explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of the others. For us, Lord, there is perplexity and doubt as to which of these good ascetics speak truth and which speak falsehood. So you can understand their doubt and their confusion. You know, they've got a lot of different teachings coming at them. The first time I heard a talk on this sutta, I think Gil was giving the talk, and he said, it's kind of like Northern California. And there's a lot of different teachings out there. So, you know, we can kind of relate to this. How do we relate to all of the stuff that's out there? So their confusion and their skepticism, probably, and all the different teachers contradicting each other, saying only this is true, when they're flatly contradicting each other, it's like, well, only one can be true. How do we know what to believe? How do we know what is true? And it's quite understandable. And also something else to point out about the sutta is that this particular teaching is given to people that were not actually his followers. You know, they were coming to him to just see what he had to say. And I think it's important to know that when we hear what he has to say. So here's the first part of his response. He says, it is fitting for you to be perplexed, O Kalamas. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. Come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reflection on reasons, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our teacher. So basically, he first affirms their confusion and says, this makes sense. You know, what you're experiencing makes sense. As he says, doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. So it's fitting for them to be confused. And then he lists 10 ways in which they should not use as criteria for judging whether something is true. And these 10 ways can roughly be broken into 3 categories. There is based on tradition, which encompasses oral tradition, lineage of teaching, hearsay, which basically means popular opinion or general consensus, or collection of scriptures. So that's the based on tradition. Then there's based on reasoning. Logical reasoning, inferential reasoning, reflection of reasons, acceptance of a view after pondering. And then there's based on personal authority, which includes the competence of the speaker or whether the person we consider the person our teacher. So this actually undercuts a lot of the ways that we typically put faith in things or confidence in things. Tradition, based on our culture, what our culture says, what our friends believe, what we hear on television. A lot of these things help us decide how we live our lives. Popular opinion in our culture tells us that we need to consume in order to be happy. And sort of as an interesting point about that, I was in the Peace Corps about 10 years ago. And the country that I was in is called Vanuatu. And somebody recently sent me an email article about Vanuatu that said the following: "The most deservedly happy place on the planet is the South Pacific island nation of Vanuatu, according to a radical new index published today. The innovative global population measure, global measure of progress, the Happy Planet Index, has been constructed using three factors: life expectancy, human well-being, and damage done via a country's environmental footprint. Vanuatu comes to the top because its people are satisfied with their lot, live to nearly 70, and do little damage to the planet. People are generally happy here because they're very satisfied with very little. This is not a consumer-driven society. Life here is about community and family and goodwill to other people. It's a place where you don't worry too much." So maybe there's another way. You know, consumerism, we think we have the idea that, well, you know, it's, we kind of believe that we don't really need to consume to be happy, but there's something inside of us that has kind of almost been constructed that way from the time we were born. So it's very hard to undercut these beliefs that we have in what we think we need to do to be happy. Many religions tell us what we need to believe in order to be happy, you know, whether in this life or the next. They tell us what kind of God to believe in, what kind of beliefs to have about that God. And we often believe that things are true simply because they've been around for a long time. You know, the tradition of something. And it's like, well, it's worked for a long time. You know, it must be right, or it must be true. It must be good. It must. And there is some, perhaps some basis in that, because some things have stood the test of time. But what the Buddha is saying is that tradition alone is not enough. It's not enough reason to say this is true. It's not really enough reason to put our faith in it. So we'll go on further as to what he tells us we can explore. But I want to keep talking a little bit more about these other categories. So with reasoning, the categories of inferential reasoning, logical reasoning, reflections on reasons, a lot of our culture is based around reasoning. We're very intellectual, reasoning, logical-oriented culture. But sometimes we don't necessarily look at what the foundations are which we're reasoning around. You know, we don't actually look and see that what we're reasoning on is a belief, not a fact. And when we reason based on facts, I mean opinions and beliefs instead of facts, we can limit ourselves and we can prevent ourselves from really seeing a truth, because our belief kind of constrains how we see the world. And then there's with respect to personal authority, or that this person is our teacher. I think it's kind of interesting that the Buddha brings this up. I mean, actually, he's a speaker of great personal authority, and a lot of people considered him teacher. And so he was even saying, you know, don't even take that as the foundation for your saying something is true. It's not enough. So what is it that the Buddha suggests that we do to go about discovering what is true? All of these things that we normally think about, he said, is not enough. So he says, when you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. And when you know for yourselves, these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should engage in them. So he's really bringing us back on ourselves, on our own experience. What is true in our experience? Now, the sutta has sometimes been called, or it was given the title in one person's translation, the Buddha's Charter to Free Inquiry. And it definitely encourages people not to accept anything on blind faith, no matter how apparently reliable the source is. But he does also point out in this statement, he says, when you know for yourselves these things are unwholesome, these things are wholesome. When you know for yourselves these things are blameless, these things are praiseworthy. When you know these things are praised or censured by the wise. So there is also this feedback that people of wisdom are taken into consideration in our reflection. But the main thing that this says to me is that we need to test whatever teachings we come across by putting them into practice and seeing the consequences. He talks about when you know for yourself this is unwholesome, abandon it. When you know for yourself this is wholesome, you should continue it. So the entire effect for me of this set of teachings that I've just laid out so far is to encourage a rigorous investigation, not just into the teachings that we've been given, but also into our own beliefs. This is not simply about what's coming into us from outside, but also what we believe. It's worthwhile investigating, is what we believe true? Tan Jeff has a comment about this sutta. One's own preferences are not to be followed simply because they seem logical or resonate with one's feelings. Instead, any view or belief must be tested by the results it yields when put into practice, and to guard against the possibility of any bias or limitations in one's own understanding of those results, they must be further checked against the experience of people who are wise. So the Buddha's instructions, when you know for yourselves, that's kind of the core of it. They're not easy instructions. It sounds simple, you know, it's easy to say, when you know for yourselves. But it's not easy. They actually encourage us to look really, really deeply, really closely at our actions and the consequences of those actions. And see, is this wholesome or unwholesome? What is this experience? So often, when we experience something, we're focused on what's out there in the world. So for instance, if I'm angry at someone, I'm typically focused out on the person I'm angry with or the situation I'm angry with. And so there, especially if there's a kind of a sense that, you know, someone has done us wrong in some way and we feel a kind of a justification about our anger, there can be a kind of a sense of rightness in that feeling of anger. and a sense that it's them that's the problem. You know, out there, that's the problem. And we tend to do that. Now, that is not what the Buddha means when he says, when you know for yourself something is wholesome. What he is requesting us to do is to turn back and look at our actual experience. So rather than focusing out there on the people out there that made us angry, turn around and say, what is it like, this experience of anger? What is that actually like? And if we look at that, if we bring our attention to that in the body and in the mind, what we'll typically find is that the experience of anger itself is unpleasant and it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel wholesome. It's actually a painful thing. Even with that feeling of rightness, the anger itself has a painful experience. And there's another story that the Buddha tells. He kind of equates this idea of anger, the mind state of anger, with picking up a hot coal to throw at somebody. And what you do when you pick up the whole coal is you burn yourself before it gets out of your hand. And that's the way anger is. You know, it eats us up inside. And if we turn our attention to the experience, we see that. We experience that. And we know for ourselves, this is not a good idea. This is unwholesome. This leads to suffering. We know that for ourselves. We feel it for ourselves. So that's the kind of investigation, or when we know for ourselves, that the Buddha is talking about. Can we look into our own experience and not continually be focused out there? They did that right, they did that wrong. But what's happening in here? Joy appears, happiness appears. That is a experience that feels wholesome. That should be continued. So we investigate, we explore our experience moment to moment to see if we can learn what makes us happy and what takes us to suffering. And it's the mindfulness, as I said earlier, it's the mindfulness that shows us, it leads us onward, showing us by simply bringing our non-judgmental, mindful presence to what we're experiencing. It shows us, this is wholesome, this is unwholesome, this leads to suffering, this leads to happiness. But the sutta also encourages us to open our hearts to the suffering of others. And if an action causes harm, not only to ourselves, but to others, it should be abandoned. So it really requests us not only to look at what's happening in ourselves, but to connect outward with other people. And he does this explicitly in this sutta by recommending and encouraging the practice of the Brahmaviharas, the four divine abodes, it's called. And these are practices of very, very wonderful, beautiful states of mind. The practice of loving kindness or metta, the practice of compassion or karuna, the practice of mudita or sympathetic joy, and the practice of equanimity or upekkha. So these practices not only help us to purify the heart and mind further of all the unwholesome states of anger, frustration, greed, aversion, but they also open us and connect us outwards to other people. So this practice is not simply about inside. It's about an inner and outer connection, but to the world of experience, not to the world of thought and reactivity. I'd also like to go back a little bit now and talk about beliefs, because beliefs are so central to us. There's so many beliefs that we hold that are like the air we breathe. We don't even see them as beliefs. They're just so much there and understood as some kind of an assumption in our world that we don't really know that they're there. And when we hold certain beliefs tightly, we limit ourselves. You know, we tend to filter our experience through those beliefs, and we kind of only accept in certain evidence that supports those beliefs. So as an example of this from my own experience, before I started meditation practice, I really thought I was a miserable person. You know, I was miserable a lot of the time. And I believed that. I believed that that was who I was, basically destined to be miserable for the rest of my life. And as I began practicing and I began just experiencing, well, actually, I'll just say one more thing. You know, I would notice every now and then that I was happy. But I didn't think it meant anything. You know, it's like, oh, well, you know, I'm happy now, but I know that 2 days from now I'm going to be miserable again. So it negated it. It's like I didn't take it in as being something that was really, you know, a part of my experience. It was filtered out because of the belief that I was miserable, that I was a miserable person. That was my identity. So as I began practicing and, you know, looking at my actual experience, I saw, yeah, happiness comes and goes. Miserable comes and goes. You know, when the miserable goes, it's gone. When the happiness is there, it's really there. You know, it's not necessary to define an identity around either one. We can simply be what we are in the moment. Beliefs can also be a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if you have a belief, I can't do X, fill in the blank, you know, whatever it is. I can't speak in front of large crowds. A lot of people have a fear of public speaking. That can be kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. When we have that belief, if we get up in front of a large crowd, thoughts start happening. I can't do this. I'm going to forget my speech. I'm not going to be able to do this. And we get agitated and anxious, and it makes it very difficult to do what we came to do. And the source of the problem is all of those thoughts, really, as opposed to simply just being there and taking the next step, doing the next thing. I had a kind of experience of how to work with this a few months ago. I was doing a lot of teaching and a lot of work 1 week, and I was exhausted by the end of the week, and I needed to teach a day-long class, and I was so exhausted. I just felt like I'd been beaten. I was just wiped out. And I woke up in the morning and I thought, there's no way I can teach today. There's just no way I can do this. But I had to do it. I just noticed this. This is a thought. And I just came back and just basically got through the day moment by moment. Every single moment. It's just like, all there is this moment. You know, I don't have to teach the whole day. All I have to do is teach this moment. That's all there is. I can do it right now. Okay. Oh, here's another moment. I can do it right now. And I just got myself through the day that way. You know, so we can really work with these beliefs and simply, moment by moment, notice what's actually happening right now. What's happening right now? And the other belief I want to just mention, because it's core in all of us, is the belief in self. On the surface, it seems like everything confirms this. You know, it seems so obvious to us that there's a self. You know, just like it's one of those pervasive air we breathe type of beliefs. It doesn't even seem like a belief. It just seems like a truth, a fact. Here I am. So we know, I mean, we have this set of memories that we have that kind of seem to confirm that we've been here all this time, and that seems to sort of support the fact that we're here. And our friends seem to respond to us the same kind of over time. But with the strength of this belief, we don't actually let in or take in the evidence that it may not be so. So, for instance, every time you sit down to meditate and say, I'm going to stay present for the breath, and you do that, and lo and behold, you find out 2 minutes later, you're lost in thought. Who did that? And 5 minutes later, when you wake up from that and come out of that reverie and say, oh, I've been lost in thought. Who did that? It happened. It was an event that happened. But we don't really notice these experiences. You didn't do that. You didn't do either one of those. It was simply an event that happened based on causes and conditions. Both of them were events that happened based on causes and conditions. We can explore a little bit into this belief of self by looking at what we're taking to be ourself at any particular moment. There's a question we can ask ourselves, who am I taking myself to be right now? Who am I taking myself to be right now? And notice what that is. I've noticed for myself that a lot of the time, what I'm taking myself to be is kind of a particular configuration of contractions and holdings. You know, it's like, yeah, this is a familiar feeling in the body. You know, I know what this is like. And yet, that isn't constant. It's something that comes and it goes. And yet there's another familiar pattern that comes up. Oh yeah, that's me too. But it's a different configuration. So we can explore what is it we're taking ourselves to be and notice how it changes throughout the day. It can change from a split second to a split second what we're taking ourselves to be. We can be a happy person, everything's fine, and then suddenly somebody walks in the room and we're an angry person and we're a revengeful person. So we can notice these changes of who we're taking ourselves to be. And we can explore, what is it? What actually is it that I think is me? And see what happens to it as you notice it. My guess is that you'll notice that it changes, that it's not stable, that it's not permanent. What we are is a process, not an entity. And that process is something we're very familiar with, but we don't really take it in as what's the actual truth of what is happening. Now, in the context of the teaching that I'm giving today, I want to say, don't take it from me. You know, come and see, try it, explore in your own experience. What do you see as yourself? What happens to it as you observe it? In the final section of the sutta, the Buddha gives a set. It's called the assurances section. So I'll read this section too. When the noble disciple has made his mind free of enmity, ill will, he has won 4 assurances in this very life. The first assurance he has won is this: if there is another world, and if good and bad deeds bear fruit and yield results, it is possible that with the breakup of the body after death, I shall arise in a good destination in a heavenly world. The second assurance he has won is this: if there is no other world, And if good and bad deeds do not bear fruit and yield results, still, right here in this very life, I live happily, free of enmity and ill will. The third assurance he has won is this. Suppose evil befalls the evildoer. Then, as I do not intend evil for anyone, how can suffering afflict me as one who does no evil deed? The fourth assurance he has won is this. Suppose evil does not befall the evildoer. Then right here I see myself purified in both respects. And what the commentary says that means is, I am purified because evil does not befall me and I do no evil. So, some of you may be familiar with Pascal's wager, that this kind of has a similar flavor. What Pascal's wager is, I'll just review it for those of you who aren't familiar with it. It's basically a argument for the benefit of the belief in God. He basically says, if you believe in God, basically, if you believe in God, then, you know, the benefits are incalculable. That, you know, you'll have heavenly reward. So if you believe in God and if God exists, so he's making this a completely logical argument. If you believe in God and if God exists, you go to heaven and your gain is infinite. If you believe in God and God does not exist, your loss is finite and therefore negligible. You may not believe in God. If you don't believe in God and God does not exist, your gain is finite and therefore negligible. And if you don't believe in God and God exists, you'll go to hell. And your loss is infinite. So he says, given this argument, you really should believe in God. I mean, so there's been a lot of reasons or refutations of this, and some of the main ones being that the belief here that he's talking about is in what might be called the Christian God that punishes and rewards based on belief as opposed to moral action. and that's one of the arguments about this. Another of the arguments about this is that, you know, can it really say that, you know, a belief based on a logical argument is a true belief? Is it a true belief if you're wagering your way into this? So given that, you know, I want to point out the major differences in the way the Buddha uses this kind of logic. So what he's saying is, it doesn't matter what you believe. These actions that you take will have consequences for you here and now. So he says, you know, if, essentially he says, these four things that he laid out, if there is a world or another world, if there is not another world, if evil befalls the evildoer. These four arguments were basically four of the arguments that these ascetic wanderers came into town and were espousing. And so he's saying, you know, it doesn't really matter what you believe of those things. If you behave in a way that you act to increase wholesome and decrease the unwholesome, if you act in ways that are skillful and lead you away from suffering and towards happiness, you will benefit in this very life. So his argument, I feel, is completely different. And I think, to me, what is so important about this is that he's saying it just doesn't matter what you believe. Act in a way that reduces suffering. That's where we'll benefit. That is really the whole thrust of his teaching, is looking at suffering. What causes us suffering? How do we end it? So run the experiment for yourself. Try it and see. You know, it's like a scientific inquiry almost. This teaching so much resonated for me because I tend to be a kind of, you know, scientific oriented person. And it's like, yeah, okay, I'll run this experiment and see what the results are. Does it benefit me? Do I see a gain here? Do I see that my life is getting easier, happier? Am I less miserable? Yes. I am less I'm basically a happy person. So for me, it has been so clear. This experiment run on my own life has produced amazing results. But try it for yourself. Try it and see. Also, as a reflection for me, this has been very skillful, particularly on retreats when I get bound up in this. Am I doing this right? You know, how do I do this? Is this the right practice for me? It's like, well, try it and see. That's what the Buddha said. Try the practice and see. Don't spin and think about it. That's not going to get me anywhere in terms of learning what the practice will do. Try it and see. Sit down, practice with the mindfulness. Bring the mindfulness into your daily life as much as you can. Observe what happens to you as you do this practice. Experience for yourself this onward leading nature of the mindfulness of the practice. So those are my thoughts on this Kalama Sutta, and we have some time if there's any comments or questions or any discussion. Yeah. The two Pali words are ehipasiko, opanaiko. I can write them down for you afterwards if you like.
Are there many spiritual traditions that lead to the truth, like Sufism, Christian mysticism? You know, are there many different traditions that lead to the truth?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Are there many different spiritual traditions that lead to the truth?
Well, I think actually they probably are. I mean, it's almost like there's a mountain and there's all these different paths up the mountain and they can all potentially lead to the truth. Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately that's the case. I mean, even in Buddhist practice, you know, there's many, many different techniques. I mean, techniques are not the truth. The techniques are a way to see the truth. Yeah.
Well, it seems like a person would have a big struggle with... When you're acting to reduce suffering, you know, who's suffering? I mean, your own suffering or somebody else's? Seems like that would be a struggle.
What's the struggle?
Well, the struggle would be whose suffering do you want to reduce?
Oh, yours or someone
else's?
It seems
like that would be a toss-up all the time.
Well,
you know, your own or somebody else's?
You know, it seems like that's the case. And in fact, you know, I kind of had this belief also around, particularly around this idea of happiness. You know, I thought, well, you know, the happier I am, it means that somebody else is not happy, and if they're happy, it means that I'm not happy. It's kind of like it's a zero-sum
game.
Yeah, and I, you know, there kind of can be a same understanding around suffering. You know, if I'm suffering, it means somebody else isn't. If somebody else is suffering, then I'm not. And I think that's actually one of those beliefs that we need to explore as a belief. You know, there may be times, in fact, where that seems to be the case. For instance, in a relationship, if one person wants to leave the relationship and another doesn't, you know, it can feel like, you know, the action of one is going to make that person happy and the other person sad. But, you know, in reality, you know, the entirety of the situation is not a happy situation for either one of them. You know, so we really have to look at what our beliefs are around, you know, I'm happy and someone else isn't. And we can kind of expand our view about the idea of, you know, make the situation a little broader. You know, war is a good example of this, you know. And, you know, it seems to me like we can step out of this a little bit by saying, you know, it doesn't mean that one person has to win and one person has to lose. And that, like, that's the kind of belief around war. You know, maybe there's another way. And I'm not saying I know the answer, but, you know, I'm just saying this is a belief that may not be true.
You mentioned in one of your examples the aspect of anger and emotion. And how does the Buddha or the teachings look at the different variety of emotions? Some one could consider positive, others consider negative. But they all seem to come from a certain space of reaction and all-encompassing feeling. And some of them are great, passion, love, etc., and others aren't so great. But so, as one practices over time, what happens to those emotions?
Well, you know, I can't say ultimately at the, you know, the end of the path.
What have you heard?
My experience, anyway, is that, you know, that the emotions continue, you know, and in fact, the range of emotion that's experienced seems to broaden. You know, there's more of the, I mean, it's not so much that there's more anger. I mean, that's not what I mean. But the depth of being able to contact the difficult states, the difficult experiences, the suffering in life, that it gets more, we feel it more and more. We feel the deepness of the suffering of the world more and more. And we also feel on the other side a beauty and joy and lightness of just being here. You know, so things get really broad. But the so-called, you know, reactive emotions or afflictive emotions, you might say, those seem to really, they really die down. I've experienced that a lot in my practice. I mean, they're certainly not gone, but they're much, much reduced. And, you know, I have understood that at certain stages of the path, those states just completely drop away. Those reactive states drop away. But that doesn't mean that emotion drops away. The emotions of compassion, mudita, of sympathetic joy, the emotion of equanimity, which actually is an emotion, the emotion of loving kindness, those become the place where we live from, as opposed to from the reactive emotions. And those, I guess, you know, one of the teachings around this area is that those emotions are kind of the base of existence almost. You know, that those emotions are there and obscured by the reactivity. And so as we let go of the reactivity, what's uncovered are these really beautiful, wholesome states of mind. It's almost, you know, opposite of the description in the in Genesis of, you know, of the original sin. You know, it's the original beauty, and it's obscured by things that are covering it. By this last statement?
The original sin is the original beauty.
I'm sorry. That was I was saying that it's the opposite of that. That in Christianity, there's this notion of original sin, where that's the kind of core, fundamental element that people, you know, feel like, well, we have to kind of overcome that. And in this teaching, it's the opposite, essentially. You know, there's a core of really beautiful, wholesome inclination, and we have to let go of what's covering it. So it kind of turns it on its head.